On March 16, 2000, two sheriff's deputies were shot in Atlanta. Jameel Al-Amin, a Muslim leader and former Black Power activist, was convicted. But the evidence was shaky, and the whole truth didn't come out during the trial. My name is Mosi Secret, and when I started investigating this case in my hometown, I uncovered a dark truth about America. From Tenderfoot TV, Campside Media, and iHeart Podcasts, Radical is available now. Listen to the new podcast, Radical, for free on the iHeart Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You don't have to be 60, wealthy, you know, extraordinary, a mogul to have a story that's valid enough to be told.
Right.
And I had to tell myself that through this process. I mean, my brother even over Christmas said to me, "Dude, Elaine, why are you writing an autobiography?"
I love how your brother calls you dude.
He's like, "Dude, yeah." And yeah, at this point in my career, he's like the only person who will just chop me down to size real fast and just be like, he's like, "Well, dude, why are you writing an autobiography? Isn't that like something old people do?"
Wow.
Like, seriously,
but you know, is he older or younger brother?
He's older than me, and he didn't mean it to be like hurtful. But he's
not understanding the history of Black literature. Which is quite often your autobiography is the first book that you publish. And you may publish it in your 20s or your 30s or whatever. But, like, I had to tell my story. You know, my name is Richard Wright. My name is, Claude Brown. My name is whatever. You know, I had to tell my story first before I could tell you anything else.
Oh, that's so powerful. That, when you put it like that, when you put this book, in this like larger trajectory of black
autobiography, literary, the last 150 years. Oh my god!
Thank you. I'm gonna take that with me because I was like, my best comeback was in the moment. They don't even call them autobiographies anymore, you asshole! And I just like burst into tears. So now I have I can come back with some weight on this. But no, I think that's powerful when you put it into perspective like that. And I just think, like, listen, you don't have to be, later I realized, I was like, that's the patriarchy talking. You don't see the value yet in the voice of a young black woman, and that's okay. You're not my audience. I'm not speaking to you. And I do think that's rule number one, like, write for your audience.
Elaine Welteroth is fierce and fabulous. She's got amazing hair, an incredible sense of style, intelligence, grace, humility, and class. She's the total package. That's why Anna Wintour chose her to become the editor-in-chief of Teen Vogue. Now, you might think the day you become the editor-in-chief of Teen Vogue when you're 29 years old is one of the best days of your life, and it was. But behind the scenes, things were a hot mess. Today, you're going to hear the whole backstory, as well as what Elaine did when she was in the halls of Condé Nast that helped propel her to that top spot and how she handled herself while she was there. She's inspiring. She's amazing. She's the author of a great new memoir called More Than Enough, and she is way more than enough. It's my homie Elaine Welteroth on Touré Show.
Part of what both of us have done is be able to go into super white spaces and succeed and carve out our own lane and our own, you know, come with our own personality and succeed. How did you do it? And what advice do you have for others who are like treading that road? Because it's hard.
It is hard. And I don't think there's one blueprint or one like... There's no magical answer to that question. I think it's a journey to figure out how to be your authentic self, which we say all the time, again, these platitudes. I think it's a journey to figure out who you are and what you have to say and how to say it in a way where people will listen to you, especially in predominantly white spaces as a black professional. That concept of double consciousness is very real and very present every day. And so I think the absolute saving grace for me and the best advice I can give is to build your tribe. Whether it's at the office or outside of the office, you need people who see you.
Yes.
Who you can who can serve as a sounding board for your ideas and who can support you behind the scenes, because you won't always find that around the table.
I mean, you'll be in a meeting or walking through the hall, someone microaggresses, you're pissed off. You can't do anything with that energy in the office.
It's not productive.
It's not productive. And you know, and it's not big enough that you can go to HR, you
right.
can go to your boss, that and you feel...
And good luck with HR.
Good luck with HR. And you feel... I would feel sort of like weak and like a loser and like I had failed Black people, but I didn't say anything. But if I'd said what I really want to say, I would have gotten fired.
Yeah, you have to choose your battles.
Yeah.
That is a key piece of advice. You have to choose your battles. There are some things that are worth the war and other things you got to take it home and grumble and strategize.
I mean, when you're in the meeting and they say, so when is the editor-in-chief going to get here?
Mm-hmm.
And you have to delicately take that in, not insult her, politely let her know, I'm the editor-in-chief, not embarrass her, because
right.
you still want to do the business with her, even though now you're like,
right.
How do you, like, you know, I mean, how do you handle that?
Yeah, I mean, you could answer that, I'm sure. I'm sure you've dealt with that kind of thing so many times. And that's what's so, Black people are so resilient.
Mm-hmm.
Our job is to take care of you.
Mm-hmm. But it beats you
and
down.
And me. And even when you hurt me, I got to protect you. And
yeah.
we do it and still we rise, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, those kinds of moments happened to me. And I shared them in the book because I think it's important that people on both sides of those awkward exchanges see themselves in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that people, the kinds of people who are on the other end of that awkward exchange, for me, like the kinds of people who put Black folks in that position, I hope they read this book and I hope they can see themselves on the other side. And I hope that it increases the empathy and the understanding for what it feels like to be put in that position. But I also wanted to say, I feel like I also shared those moments because they're not proud moments for me. Like I would handle those kinds of microaggressive moments very differently now. Because I've found my voice, and I think that.
So, how would you handle it now?
I think I would be less concerned with the other person's comfort now.
Okay.
And I don't think that it's my responsibility to take care of everyone in the room. And I think that actually sometimes those are opportunities. Those are opportunities for the other person to experience the discomfort that they've created.
What if it costs you the business?
Well, you...
We're trying to do a deal. I'm
right.
trying to get hired. I'm trying to stay here, whatever it may be.
Yeah.
And you kind of tweak somebody because they've
right.
insulted you.
You have to do... You kind of have to take a breath and do a quick, you know, cost-benefit analysis in your mind. Is this a war worth fighting, or is this a little battle I got to grumble about later? Or do I say something after? I think tone matters so much.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's just easier for you personally, for your own psyche and for your own self-care, to in the moment just make light of it, make people laugh, and move on, because sometimes that's a demonstration of real power.
Mm, interesting.
And I think, you know, so like the moment where I share in the book when the woman in the Midwest, all white office, I walk in and she says to me, oh, thank you so much for being here. You know, they've had you running all around here like a slave. And then all the oxygen in the room just evaporates.
Right.
And it just feels like a spotlight is on me.
Right.
What are you going to do?
Right.
And Trey, I'm sure you've been in this. A similar situation, maybe they didn't call you a slave, but
no,
you know, that
not
was
that, but
a little overt. But in that moment, I you know, I'm just like, what do I do here? What do I do here? I'm extremely uncomfortable. I'm gonna act like that didn't happen. Keep moving. Today, Elaine 2019, there's no way I would not, there was no way I would handle it that way.
I would
allow the pregnant pause to persist.
just let her drown.
I would just let her feel that one. We're just gonna sit in this pregnant pause, and I'm gonna let you figure out what to say next.
Right.
I'm gonna turn the spotlight that's on me onto you.
Right.
And let's let you figure out how to get yourself out of the corner you put yourself in.
Right.
Versus me come in to rescue you.
Right.
So that, I think there's like a paradigm switch that's happened, but a paradigm shift that's happened. But it's not just because, you know, I've grown up and I've found my voice. It's because also the world has changed so much, even in the last 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the conversations that we're having are so different now than they were then about race,
mm-hmm.
and about microaggressions and about representation, diversity, inclusion. Like, we're finally having conversations where I think that white people in positions of power are more prepared to have these kinds of confrontations in the moment. And if they're not, they should be.
They should be.
The conversations are in the ether.
But, like, one of the things you talk about, you're doing the beauty work and you notice that the white woman doesn't know anything about black beauty standards. So it's like, I have to know your stuff. You're at this level. You don't have to know. I mean, surely there are black consumers of Teen Vogue and Vogue, and you're just, what is it, 10% of the readership is black, right? And you don't pay any attention to it. I mean, this is a significant group. Right?
And increasing.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, that's a perfect example of, you know, the kind of latent racism that we normalize in corporate America.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important to shine a light on it so that we think more critically about that and go, oof.
So
you're right. That ain't really right. That's not right. That's not right. As a white beauty editor, should be expected to put myself in the position of my reader. And my reader is not exactly just like me.
Right. Right.
You know, and as a black editor, I have to do that every day.
Right. Right. Right, right. What are your rules for surviving and thriving in these white corporate spaces? What does Elaine, Auntie Elaine,
Auntie E,
tell the children that they need to do?
Auntie E, tell the children. Well, let's see. What have I already said? Because I think I want to recap too.
Pick your battles.
Pick your battles.
Mm-hmm.
Find your tribe. Find your voice.
Don't save them.
Oh, yes. Don't save them. That's a good one. And I think we have to, and this is going to sound like a platitude, but I really think we need to own our power and not wait for someone to give it to us.
Okay.
I think we don't. So what I mean by that is we have been conditioned to assimilate in order to be accepted and to get promoted,
yeah,
and to be heard and seen in these white spaces. But what we need to remember is that we are bringing something valuable to every room that we step into. And we are doing a disservice to the organization, to the group that we're a part of, if we're not bringing our full authentic self to the table. Our culture is rich, and our perspectives are dynamic, and they are missing from the conversation. So part of your contribution requires you to lean into really who you are and to not leave it outside of the room just because you've been conditioned by our society to feel like it's not good enough, it's not worthy enough, it doesn't fit here.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like, it's our responsibility to bring it in and bring it to the table. And it takes time to practice how to figure out how to find your voice and how to insert your culture and to stand up for your people and all that stuff. It takes time to figure out how to do it right. But when you do, there's power in that. And mm-hmm. actually the culture of the room shifts when you decide to bring all of you.
There's a great moment, though, where you're struggling with something and you call a rich white man and he says, just do it.
Yes.
And you're like, I'm uncomfortable doing that. And he's like, just do it.
Right. Don't think about what they're going to say.
Right, right, right. And it's like,
that's okay, a privilege. That's a privileged mindset.
Yes, but I'm going
to. We don't inherit our parents.
Right, right, right.
We inherit the opposite.
I'm going to do that. I'm going to do what the privileged white man would do and see what happens.
Right.
Right.
Woo! And those allies are really important in those moments, for sure. I remember coaching myself the night before a big negotiation, like with this privileged white Jewish man. And he, you know, I was so nervous about asking for what I felt I deserved. And he just modeled for me complete confidence. Like, ask for what you think you deserve. Don't worry about what
they
say.
Tell them a number.
Just tell them the number. And I was just like, but what if? And every time I said, what if? And thinking about the other side, stop thinking about what they're going to say. Do it anyway. And imagine if we were raised with that. I mean, it would be delusional confidence for Black folks to, but that is, I wanted to borrow some of that. Yeah. I wanted to try some of that on for size, and it wasn't easy. It's literally like unlearning everything you've learned as survival tactics as a Black person.
Yeah.
You know? But I think it's all a part of that umbrella of owning your power. Sometimes we have to borrow the privileged mindset and put it on and see how it works. I mean,
you've talked a lot today about your growth from the person who you talk about in the book. And there was a moment I had an interesting conversation with my wife because when you are offered the beauty director job at Teen Vogue, you said no.
When I was offered the beauty, yeah. Sorry, yes.
And you said, I'm not prepared. I'm not ready for this job. And I'm sitting there going, what is she talking about?
What man in America ever turned down?
Right, just get in there and you'll figure
title,
it out. Right,
because you're a bigger salary.
I'm smart. I can read. I have friends. I can figure it out. I'll get in there and I'll figure it out. And my wife is like, that's not how a woman would look at it. And I'm like,
that's not how we were socialized.
Right.
Thankfully,
they shove you into the job anyway.
Right.
Your career keeps ascending. But is that a young mindset? Is there any job that Elaine now would say, I'm not ready. I'm going to say no, even though it's an amazing promotion. Do you now feel like I can do anything?
You know, I do feel like I have become friends with fear now. Where I don't require like an absence of fear to move forward into a challenge.
Good.
The way I used to. But I do think that it's a part of the female experience to question yourself because of how we have been conditioned for generations. And I'm just glad now that I have a network of women who I can turn to and say, I'm scared.
Mm.
And I'm doubting myself. And here's why. Am I crazy? Should I do this? What do you think? And on the other side, I have women who I respect and admire and who've done incredible, extraordinary things who can reflect my power back to me and check that self-doubt and help me push past it. And that's why I say having a tribe of women around you, women of color, if you are a woman of color, who see you and see your value and can remind you of it when you forget it. I think that's the thing. I don't think that we should, you know, there's a myth, I think, that in order to be successful and powerful as a woman, that you have to be fearless. I don't think fearlessness
is possible.
Is
not possible.
I don't think it exists. I don't think it's real. I think that we all experience fear as humans.
Yeah.
But it's about how you dance with fear and that relationship that you have with fear. I think that can change.
Interesting.
Over time. But I'm sure there are still opportunities that someone could present and I'd be like,
I don't know.
Me? Now? I don't know.
I think you could do anything. I want.
Thank you. I'll call you next time, Teray. Next time I feel that, I'm gonna call you.
You should call me. You Elaine Welteroth. You could do anything, girl. What?
Yes.
I want to talk about what for me is the central awesome story of the book. But before we get to how you got to Teen Vogue and be the head of Teen Vogue, there's so much in this book about hair and the politics of hair and the beauty of hair and. Just before we start to dive into that, what is the hair care regimen? Because you are looking fantastic and fabulous again today. I mean, it's like this great lion's mane of like blonde and brown and curls and like it's so modern and proud and right, like, you know, Black is Beautiful, Angela Davis, but like modern and like, so I love it. I love the way you show up with your hair.
Thank you.
And when you were introduced as the editor-in-chief of Teen Vogue and like, here's this picture. I mean, like, people were celebrating not just because an African-American person had that job, but like, look, she's down. She's like all in. Look at this hair, my God. And it was a huge source of pride for so many people. Mm. I didn't know who you were before you got the job, but I was proud too. Mm. Oh my God!
How
look
did
at her.
You find out?
Oh God!
How I did it reach you?
You know how it reached me is I saw a tweet that said, and this is one of the greatest tweets ever. The person said, "Most of the," and I'm going to paraphrase it a little bit. Most of the media, colon, how do we deal with Trump? Teen Vogue, hold my beer. And I was like, Teen Vogue? What? And then I started Googling, like, oh, shit, Elaine. Oh, shit, she's awesome. Like, wow, look at this. Oh, my God. Teen Vogue is making people proud. Oh, my God.
Wow.
So that's how it started for me. But what is the hair care regimen?
It is so funny, by the way, to hear a man's perspective on hair, like on a woman's hair, and the fact that you're even remarking on it, I'm like, your wife trained you well.
I think I was into hair before her.
Oh, you're trying to take credit for this?
Well, no, I mean, like, you know, I mean, look, you know, I'm born 1971, right? I grew up right watching certain person dance with his brothers and sisters, so it's like, you know, big hair was like super important and valuable, and
right.
Like, I mean, you know, my dad was gray from when he was 18. Right? But he had this gray afro, right? So he stood out because he has this gray afro, even though he's 40 or 50 or whatever is going through.
That's iconic.
Yeah. No, it really was, like, way before he should have been gray. So, yeah, I mean, I always wanted to have as much hair as I possibly can.
Wait, are you mixed race?
I am not. My father was lighter than you are, but I'm not mixed.
Okay. But he had a big gray afro.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. That's kind of great. So let's see. What's the question? My hair. I think it's so interesting. I think there's always – first of all, we know that black hair is extremely politicized.
Mm-hmm.
So by default, it becomes an extension of your identity as a black woman.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, looking back over my career, it's like it's almost mirrored my journey of – getting acquainted with myself.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So there have been times where it's like where I've feel like I've had to shrink and my hair shrinks along with me.
Mm.
And then there are times where I feel powerful and strong and my hair reflects that and it's
mm-hmm.
big. And
mm-hmm.
And I, like throughout my Teen Vogue trajectory in particular, it just got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And now it's just huge. And I think it really does. It's weird. You don't think about it consciously, of course, but it is about taking up space. And it is about kind of claiming kind of like what's yours is enough. It's saying what's mine, what I was born with is enough.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of, it's one of those things that's like you train people. You train people how to treat you. You train people how to see you. You train people how to interact with you by how you show up. And by saying, by walking into the room with my natural hair, it's like, I am unapologetic and you will not touch it.
Mm.
And, you know, like there are certain rules of engagement with natural hair. And
did you think about straightening it to go into Teen Vogue?
I definitely interviewed with it. Slicked back into a tight little bun. That was my interview hair.
Okay.
Black girls know about the interview hair.
Yeah.
It is different from the everyday hair.
Oh, no doubt.
Because you're not sure what you're dealing with. So you go in and you go with the safe hair just in case it distracts from your resume. And so, you know, coming up through the ranks at Glamour in particular, I felt like that was a part of my career where I was really like, She was assimilating. She was wearing khakis and pearls and, you know, I was kind of keeping my hair in a tight bun. Of course, I still wore my curls, but I was just much more conscious of, you know, the way I looked and what that might communicate and wanting to be safe and approachable and all that kind of stuff. And it just sort of over time, as I got comfortable with myself and what I had to say in the world as a journalist, as a storyteller, it just kind of went out the door. And I was just like, the bigger and the better.
When you said assimilating.
It is particularly big today.
Well, what is the regimen?
Oh, yeah, the regimen. Well, actually, my regimen is I do not shampoo my hair.
Okay.
Actually,
as a rule?
Very rarely. Unless I have a ton of product buildup, then I usually don't shampoo with a traditional shampoo.
Okay.
I... and this is not novel for anyone who has natural hair, so I'm not trying to pretend like this is like something you've never heard before, but I co-wash. So I wash my hair with a conditioner and I finger comb it in the shower.
Okay.
And then I use Diva Curl styling cream. That is my go-to. That is the singular product I use. I am very low maintenance when it comes to my hair. I do not have a lot of time to be dealing with it. So I use this one product. I put it all through my hair whenever I do rinse it and do the whole co-washing thing, which, by the way, is like an Olympic sport. It takes so much time.
How long
my arms are burning.
How
it depends on how long I've waited. And I have a tendency of letting it go a little bit too long. And the kitchen is it is hot back there. Right, you know, like you can't really put your fingers through. Sometimes I have some dreadlocks forming in the back.
Oh, no doubt.
So if I let it go too far, it takes a really, really, really long time. My
but
arms
you don't
are
want
like
to separate
burning.
It too much because that's not
but
a
yeah,
good look either.
Yeah. And like I also will say first and second day are not, I mean, those are the boring days. Like your hair is just it's almost too springy and flat. I love it when it's a little bit dirtier.
Uh-huh.
I love it when it's like fourth day,
uh-huh.
third, fourth day, because I like a little frizz. I like when it's big.
Sometimes you need stories that reflect the community, the culture, the world that you love. You can get some of that on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths, where you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and how to create world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is an account of what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective and diving into the things that we care about and the stories we want to hear that center Black perspectives. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes that celebrate the Black experience. Turn on NPR and listen to Black Stories, Black Truths, because Black stories make up what it means to be in America, and stories should never be told without us. Listen to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR wherever you get your podcasts. Great Expectations is a new novel from the New Yorker staff writer Vincent Cunningham, a keenly observed novel about a young Black man searching for his place in the world amidst a moment of historic change. Great Expectations is about the main character David's 18 months working for Senator Obama's 2008 presidential campaign. Along the way, David meets all sorts of people who raise questions about history, art, race, religion, and fatherhood that force David to look at his life in a new way and come to terms with his identity as a young Black man in America. Colm McCann says Great Expectations will be one of the most talked about novels of the year. And others have called this book epic, intimate, and brimming with brilliance. It got a starred review in Publishers Weekly, which is a big deal. And it's a coming-of-age story that takes you inside the Obama campaign like nothing else. Great Expectations is an extraordinary book available wherever books are sold.
Influencer. It's a word that gets tossed around a lot these days. There is a woman who went the distance, who broke ground as the first true influencer by living a remarkable life. Her name, Elizabeth Taylor. I'm Katy Perry. This is the story of the original influencer. This is Elizabeth the First. Elizabeth the First, the podcast, wherever you listen.
The central story for me in this book that really leapt off the page, that I really underlined, this just really powerful story, was when you are getting the editor-in-chief job mm-hmm. at Teen Vogue. And from the outside, it was like, oh my God, coronation, so exciting, yay! But it was extraordinarily emotional and complex for you. Can you tell the story of what happened and how you're feeling as you're going through it? Because it's a heavy sort of corporate moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, we love a celebration. We love, as a culture, we love
firsts.
To see firsts. We love to see each other win, and I think that's great. I love to see my sisters win too. But I think we often therefore do not feel like there's space to talk about the underside of dreams realized as Black people who are firsts, or as Shonda Rhimes says in her book, first, only different, F-O-D. I think when the conversation ends at the celebration, it leaves those who are in these roles to feel isolated, because there's but only so much space there's only so much of the story that gets told, right? And you're meant to just be grateful and make the best of it and be excellent. Work four times as hard as the next person in that role, and you just do the work. That's sort of the mandate for somebody who is first, only, indifferent. And I learned that. For me, when I got this job, you know, I had been working at Teen Vogue for a while. We had been doing some really kind of culture shifting work that was resonating, and there was momentum building. And we were so, all of us at Teen Vogue were really proud of the work that we were putting out into the world. And so when I got promoted, there was this interesting moment where there was a duality to this experience for me. You know, what the public saw is that I got this great promotion. Teen Vogue promoted this young Black girl to run it. And it was the
youngest editor in Condé history.
Yeah, all that.
And she's Black.
Yes.
And she's,
it's a win for the culture.
Yes.
And, you know, and Black Twitter, you know, went off. Everyone was so excited. You saw the tweet and, you know, my phone blew up. But behind the scenes, there was another reality that I was living where certainly I was excited about getting this opportunity, especially at a moment where there was so much momentum and there was so much work to be done. And I felt like this was my job to have. There was so much for me to say. And yet, you know, when I was offered the opportunity, it came with sort of, I was put in a compromising position, because I was offered it alongside two other people who we'd been working together. And
so it's going to be a tripartite leadership something thingy.
Right. And it was sort of like, you know, sign this form. We're going to announce this in 40 minutes.
And there's no negotiation.
No opportunity to negotiate.
Talking about it.
Yes. It was tricky.
And you say you weren't thrilled with the salary bump. I'm the editor-in-chief now. This is not what? This is it? It's supposed to be more than this?
Yeah. And I think what that, in the moment, I wasn't prepared with the tools to be able to negotiate for myself or to even know how to handle that situation. I certainly wanted the opportunity. I was certainly grateful for the opportunity, but the circumstances around that opportunity put me in an uncomfortable position. And I was sort of put in this spot where it was like, take it as it is or leave it. And you have like 40 minutes to figure that out. And, you know, the press release is going to go out one way or either way, the press release will go out with your name or without your name. And it was sort of this, it was so surprising for me. And I felt shocked and I didn't know how to handle it. And I think I did my best to try to advocate for myself. But ultimately, I realized that the opportunity in front of me was something I couldn't pass up. So I was going to do what Black women have done for generations. And I was going to make lemonade. And I was going to have to prove over time that I was valued, actually more valuable than maybe they recognized up front.
Think a white girl would have been given a different package or different opportunity?
You know, who will ever know? Right. But what I think the point of me sharing it is to expose that this is not something that happens only at Condé Nast or in the media world or to me.
Right.
This is something that happens all the time, every day, in every industry. I think there also are some sort of it's a systemic issue. Black women often are underpaid and overworked and underestimated. especially in leadership roles. We know that. And we know the stats about the wage gap, but we rarely talk about the, like, anecdotally do we talk about how it happens. And, you know, when I was in this position, I knew the stats, but I still was shocked that it was happening to me. And I still didn't have the tools to be able to navigate it in a way that made me feel powerful.
Yeah.
So I, you know, but behind closed doors, when I talk to any woman of color who is in a leadership role, they are not surprised. They've been put in similar positions. And yet there's almost this like cone of silence around the shame of what it feels like to be in that position. And so we essentially protect the companies and the power structures that put us in these positions by silencing ourselves. And so I feel like, it put me in a really awkward position where I was being celebrated by my community.
Right.
For breaking through a glass ceiling.
Yeah.
But I didn't have the space to say, this hurts. It comes with bruises and scars and cuts, and it's not fun, and it's always. I didn't have the space to do that. And so now I feel like I owe it to the next generation to crack open these harder conversations so that they are more prepared when this happens, because it will happen, because it's a systemic problem.
So if your mentee Keisha called you.
Why she gotta be Keisha?
Because she's just a black girl.
Hey, Keisha.
And she's like,
can we call her Kiki?
Sure.
Do you love me?
And she's like, Auntie Elaine, like, you know, they just gave me an incredible job.
Right.
But they did not give me the money.
Right.
Or the power.
Right.
Or the corner office or all the stuff that goes with it. But right. The rest of the world's going to think this is amazing.
Right.
Basically, if Elaine called you from that room
right.
saying they gave me a crappy offer, but the job is amazing, what would you tell her? What should she do? What does current Elaine understand that she should have right. done in that moment, if anything?
Right.
Because perhaps there's nothing I can do.
Right. Well, one thing I'll say is because it happened to me and because of how I handled that responsibility, because of what I did with that role, and now because I'm writing this book and telling the story, the backstory, that girl won't even need to call me.
Right.
She will know,
right.
first of all, this happens. Second of all, if I decide to move forward with this, I can reclaim my power in this.
Mm.
And my community's response is going to be a part of that, which I want to speak to that a little bit because kind of the – there's so much I have to say about this. So the other part of this is that the world has changed so much since then, that there is an understanding now of the value of the Black audience who's watching.
Is there really?
Yes. Are you kidding? Black mm-hmm. Twitter? No one wants to be on the wrong side of Black Twitter.
Sure.
So I think when I got my promotion, I don't think either of us expected the Black Twitter audience ecosystem.
Yeah.
To A, find out, B, react the way they did.
Okay.
But because Essence Magazine broke the story, and with the headline, I think it's Black Girl Magic, it was a Black Girl Magic alert, and it was like Elaine Weltroth became the editor-in-chief of Teen Vogue, and we all rejoiced, something like that.
Right.
It immediately elicited this massive viral celebration of Black folks. That mm-hmm. were rising up and saying,
really did.
This matters to us. Mm-hmm. Congratulations, sis. Like, all this support came pouring in
mm-hmm.
that I wasn't expecting, and certainly the institution wasn't expecting. And in this powerless moment where I felt like I was being stuck into a situation that was really compromising, I saw this response from my community lifting me up, affirming me, and it gave me my power back in a moment where I felt powerless. And it made me reflect and remember that I'm here representing them.
Yes.
I'm here actually on the inside working for all of us on the outside. And that gave me power. I think as women, it's harder to advocate for ourselves than it is to advocate for others. Mm-hmm. And when you remember that you're walking into the room and you're representing thousands of people who are who've never been spoken to directly in the way that you can in this role, it empowers you to ask for what you deserve or what you feel you deserve. And so there was this moment where, like, I just realized, wow, there is something really there was something about that moment that I think I learned that Black culture comes with a currency that we sometimes discount, like, even at, mm-hmm. But when those voices came in, I cannot tell you, it gave me leverage. It gave literal leverage to walk back into the room and say, we need to negotiate. I need space to negotiate this. And if I didn't, how can I possibly talk to all these? How can I possibly make this look good and be the sort of token Black hire for all these folks who are looking at me and celebrating this? Like, it was something that I felt like I had to do. I had to go back in and negotiate that. And it got marginally better with that. It got marginally better. But ultimately, it was the work that ultimately the company had to realize mattered and was valued more. And a year later, I eventually got the title
and the corner office
and the full package that, you know, I felt was more commensurate.
Did you feel like a
token? Certainly.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I did. It was hard. It is hard to be the only one. It is hard to be first, but it's not, you know, I think it comes with a great opportunity too. Because you can open the door and make sure that there's a second and a third. And now there is. And the next editor-in-chief who came after me is a young Black woman who was even younger than I was when I got the job. And so to me, that's the true marker of success. The culture has shifted and there's space for more than just me.
You kind of referenced some of the tension that I've been dealing with throughout my media career, that I go into Rolling Stone, MSNBC, wherever, and feel like I am representing the culture. Mm. So, you know, you got to be on your game, you know, and bring in our issues. But I don't want to be a spokesperson for the culture, because that is minimizing. And it suggests one person can be the spokesperson. And I can know what, you know, I wrote a book about the complexity of Black people. So I can't say Black people feel like X, right? So it's been that sort of push and pull of, how do I represent the culture? But then also, it has to be me. It has to be authentically me and what I believe in. I can't just say such and such because the culture wants to hear that.
Right. Oh, my gosh. I've been there. And that goes to the earlier point that I was making about, you know, it takes time to figure out how to speak, quote unquote, on behalf of your community while also being true to yourself and also getting shit done in the system.
Oh yeah, that part of actually doing the job and crushing it.
Right. So, you know, it's a journey. And there's that other story that I shared about learning the hard way when you're trying to negotiate these things, and you make a wrong calculation, and then the very community that you feel like you're there representing gets mad at you. You know, it's like we walk as Black people in white organizations, we are walking this tightrope every day.
Well, you talk about this story where you bring in the cornrows, right? You bring in the Black hair, but you put it on a mixed model who did not read Black to others, right? And you flog yourself for not putting dark skin women in it, which would have made it clear what your intention was.
Sure.
And I think a lot of people didn't quite understand that it was a Black woman behind all this. But in a larger sense, I cringe most of the time that we talk about cultural appropriation. And I think there are definitely times when it is serious and we need to call it out and we need to have recognition and we need to be seen, right? But there's a lot of times when it's so petty and the least little thing, and we want to run around screaming appropriation. And if we were as mad about Flint as we are about appropriation, they would have clean water. If we were as mad about, you know, about police violence in L.A., we would, that would be solved as we are. But I mean, like, I'm like,
preach,
really?
Torre.
Like, again, with the appropriation, come on, guys.
Yeah.
It's not that deep.
You know, it's interesting. I don't think we realize that it's generational privilege that allows us the space to even address the issue of cultural appropriation.
Yes. Yes.
It is an intellectual argument.
Yes.
And I am not taking away from this, you know, this push. I think it is an important thing to address. That being said, you know, I get checked by my mother, who's like, girl, cultural what?
right.
I didn't have time to worry about
right.
who was wearing braids.
Right.
I was trying to keep my job.
Right.
So y'all knew these new blacks, you know, she's just like this new generation.
New
y'all,
Negroes.
These new Negroes, you know, so I understand, like, I just think we need to put things into perspective and remember where we came from and remember the struggles of the civil rights era and really put cultural appropriation in perspective. Like, as long as we're contextualizing it and giving it the appropriate way, you know, versus I think sometimes we get into this position and it makes sense when you've been in a powerless position for generations and finally you're in a position of policing those who've been policing you, your body, and your families, and your, you know, your lineage has been policed by white folks since forever. So now I'm in a position to police you to tell you you don't get to wear your hair like this, and here's why.
Right.
And I'm going to take that, and I'm going to run with it. And I think there is a little bit of that sometimes in the whistleblowing that we do on Instagram. I mean, on social media.
Everywhere, yeah.
You know, and we live in cancellation culture. We love a cancellation. Even, I said earlier, we love a celebration, but we love a cancellation even more. And we love to be able to call someone out, and I just think... Sometimes we have to refocus ourselves on what the real movement is about, where we're really going, and what is our focus. And we need to align on it, because if sometimes I think how we come across is just angry.
Yeah.
And when that's the perception, I don't think that we're moving anyone towards. I don't think we're gaining momentum in our movement when we're just
not with that. No.
But it's complex. Like, listen, cultural appropriation is a complex issue, and I'm not trying to say that it isn't important.
I think it's important at times.
I think there are
some times when we call it out and it's accurate and appropriate, but I think quite often we use that stick too much, and we should focus on other. You talk about cancellation. Culture, I thought it would be a lot easier and quicker to cancel Michael Jackson, and a lot of people are fighting against it. Like, I don't want it. You don't know, you weren't there. I'm like,
can I tell you how deflated I feel about this issue within our own community?
Right.
I mentioned my mom, by the way. My mom is like the hero of this book. Once you read this book, you're like, Elaine's cool, but her mom is a hero. I love her. So I love my mom, and I'm not throwing her under the bus when I say this, but even my mother refuses to watch the documentary.
Mm.
And that's hard. That's hard for me. And I do think this is, again, a generational thing where I think our parents' generation really needed these black heroes.
I mean,
to be heroes.
As a millennial and even as a Gen Xer, we cannot understand the civil rights movement thing that he was bringing forward when the Jackson 5 was stepping. I mean, that was like a major moment in politics as well as culture.
Absolutely.
That we don't understand. We were not there. We did not need that. But I can't.
They're not ready. What kinds of conversations are you having with black people about Michael Jackson right now?
It's either left or right.
Right.
It's either, yeah.
Either you're ready to face it
or
you're not.
Yeah, man, that documentary was insane. Oh, my God, he's a monster. Or, no, I don't believe that. That's bullshit. Like, some white man told you, like, what? No. What are you talking about? Like, and just rejecting.
Right.
And
there's this knee-jerk rejection.
Yes.
And it's the same thing.
And they want to pivot to, and where's the Harvey Weinstein doc? I'm like, what does that matter? What does that have to do with anything?
Like, this is one of those issues where race does not actually play a role.
Right.
And I think it's hard for some Black people to recognize that. You know, like, race doesn't always, isn't always, like, a part of the equation. I really think it's the same mindset that a lot of Black people had during the OJ era.
Mm.
Where
well, that was different because OJ didn't do it.
I'm kidding.
But when I was at MSNBC, I used to torture all, because I'm the only Black person on the team, I used to torture them by saying, he got off. He was acquitted. What are you talking about? And, you know, just culturally, colloquially, we just say, well, of course OJ did it. I'm like, he was acquitted. Like, what are you talking about? And they were like, is he serious? Is he joking?
So you were just mess with
we
him.
We are triggered that he's even.
You
and
were
I'm
just
like,
mess with him.
He was acquitted. I don't know. You believe in
that
the justice
right,
system,
Torrey.
But here you go. Oh, I loved it. That was the
God
best.
Don't like
that was
ugly.
So much fun. It was so much fun.
God don't like ugly. But that actually.
He got his. He paid. He paid his bill.
Yeah. Mm. But that was an interesting social experiment in my household. Mm. I was in third grade when that happened, and I only understood it through the lens of my parents at the dinner table.
Sure.
In their conversation. And, you know, I have a Black mother and I have a white father, and they were very clearly on two different sides of this great debate.
Mm, really?
Yes. And my dad was just, who's very fact oriented, is just like that he did it. He is guilty. Mm-hmm. End of story. Mm-hmm. And my mom comes from a generation of Black people who have seen, we've seen Black, I mean, this isn't even just generational. We see this today every day, but so many Black men are screwed by this system.
Yeah.
And so my mom's perspective was sort of, if we got one.
Right. Right.
Who didn't. Right. Who got off.
Right. Right. I'm not mad.
I'm not mad at it.
Right. Right. Right.
And I was just, it's sort of, it's like we have a different understanding of what defines justice, mm-hmm. I think. And so on some level, to a lot of people, that represented a moment where, like, justice was not served. But for a lot of Black folks, O.J. represented justice.
Yeah.
Getting off represented justice for Black people.
Oh, yeah. Totally.
And it's something I don't think a lot of white people can wrap their head around.
No.
Because they're like, look at the facts.
Right.
You know?
No.
Look at these facts. No. So anyway, as it relates to Michael Jackson, I think it's like Black people just have a really hard time looking at, like, they're a fallen hero, a fallen Black hero. They just can't accept.
I mean, we have been trained to love him since, the
early beginning
70s.
Of time.
Early, you know, the thing that kills me is, I'm out here rooting for everybody Black. I didn't even know that Jordy Chandler was Black. Like, I didn't know. Like,
right.
I didn't know.
And why aren't we rooting for Jordy? Yeah.
Right. Why wasn't I showing up for Jordy?
We for showing up for Black boys.
And he killed himself because the pain was so much. And I didn't even know. I wasn't even showing up for him. We're just like, well, Michael said, so let's keep marching. Let's keep going. Like, I didn't even know. I didn't even bother to know.
And now that kind of, I mean, Jussie Smollett.
What about him?
It's all a part of the same conversation. Rooting for everybody Black is what led so many people.
So what you saying about Jussie?
What you saying about Jussie?
I'm saying he didn't do nothing. What you saying?
Yeah, okay, here we go. Are we going to go there? Well, I'm saying, first of all, I will say.
You wanted to pay Chicago for wasting their time?
No, we have many, many more reasons to question the motives of the CPD.
Chicago PD, absolutely.
Then we do Jussie.
And Black sites.
And I think that the narrative that we've been fed is from the perspective of the CPD. And
100%.
I think we don't have.
They were coming out doing preaching and editorials and press conferences. And I'm like, this doesn't seem like a police presentation. You seem like a political presentation that you're trying to rally people against Jussie. Like, you extra.
When in the history of ever have you ever seen the CPD do this much work this quickly and work so hard publicly to sort of make themselves seem like they have no fault? Like, Chicago is like I think they want us to they wanted to vilify Jussie And I think that was a red flag. What?
Right.
And also,
just stick to the crime.
Just
you don't
stick
have to
the
destroy
crime.
Him.
Also, yes, and like the thing is that we've been told there's evidence, but what evidence? We haven't been told what the evidence really is, and I don't even. There's this is like a whole other talk
so
show.
You think
but what I will say is
you,
until
do you believe the Chicago PD's narrative that he?
No, I believe that Jesse's innocent until proven
right.
guilty.
Right. Although I don't know why he's wearing a noose hours later.
What did he do?
He's wearing the noose hours later. Like, why are you still wearing it? Like, come
well,
on,
well, but
man.
There's, I don't know. I listened to his Good Morning America interview. And while some people saw that and thought, oh, God, he's not credible. He's lying. He's clearly lying. I looked at it and I thought, I understand where he's coming from. Mm. To me, he felt more credible after watching that interview. And I understand why if this happened to you and it's a hate crime and it's one that's so hard to believe because it's so extreme, you're going to show up to the police station or to the hospital with as much physical evidence as you can to support the story.
But why wouldn't you just rip it off? Somebody put a noose on my neck, I'd rip that off. Like, yeah, no.
I
mean, I see your point. I see your point.
Yeah, like you're going to show them what you look like directly after the attack versus why you wouldn't go take a shower, get rid of all the evidence. No, go in and show what it looked like. I mean, you'd have to be really, truly out of your mind to orchestrate this level of an attack on yourself.
Right.
In the public eye.
Right.
And I just think that, you know, we're not that many degrees. There aren't many degrees of separation between myself and Jesse. We know many people in common, and I feel like we would have heard.
One degree. He was on the show.
He was on the show. Okay, so you tell me what your character assessment is, but I have not heard from anyone that Jesse was crazy or a crazy intention seeker or someone who's delusional or someone who lies a lot. Like,
none of that.
If that has not come forward, then I'm sorry, but I have more reasons to distrust the CPD than I do Jesse.
But at the same time, right?
And I'm rooting for everybody black, and I'm gonna ride for Jesse until you give me a really, really, really good reason.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt.
I'm
with
that
him.
That bandwagon.
I'm on his side. I feel like public opinion among black people has largely come down against him.
I do too.
Chris Rock. Like, does Chris Rock drive by, like, I'm not calling you Jesse no more. Like, whoa.
What's he gonna call him?
Jesse.
That
I mean,
right.
It's stupid, but, you know, Rock and his position in the culture, and for him to, like, you know, have a little drive-by joke, like that.
And I do think that reflects a problem in our culture because, you know, I root for everybody black until they get canceled, and then I'm jumping right off. Like, we are so quick to get on a bandwagon and even quicker to jump off.
Mm.
And so it's like, is this loyalty that we feel towards each other real? Is this I feel like we owe it to Jesse to ride this out with him. And I was really actually kind of hurt when I saw how quickly people turned on him just because the headlines shifted.
Yeah.
Like, as a journalist, I know how easy it is to manipulate public opinion with a headline.
Yeah.
And when you have a motive behind that, I really have a hard time with the clickbait culture that we live in and with this idea that we don't think for ourselves. We would just we sort of blindly retweet. We just retweet what we see on Twitter without forming our own opinions and without thinking about the counter narrative and without, you know, having more nuanced conversations. Not everything is black and white, and not everything is as you're told. And I think we need to be more critical of the information that we were being fed every day. And that's from Jesse to what's coming out of the Trump administration. We have to be more critical about the information that we're being fed. So
let's take a step back into your career.
Because now we're all deep on a left turn.
But I love that.
At Jesse Avenue.
We're magazine people, and you worked for and with one of the great legendary editors of all time. What'd you learn from Anna Wintour?
I learned how to be decisive. I learned how to be clear with feedback, and I learned how to be ruthlessly protective of my time in order to maximize efficiency. Like, that woman's schedule, she gets more done in a day than Beyonce. She's so economical with her words.
Okay, the Bajancy's gonna get you, but it was
I know, right? Come for me, y'all.
It wasn't a diss.
Right, it's not a diss, okay? Maybe, okay, yeah, oh God. But don't come for me, y'all. Don't come for me, Black Twitter. But she's just really, I don't think that Anna gets enough credit for just how open-minded she actually is.
Mm.
And how creative she is, and how open to new ideas and young voices she is. I mean, I get a lot of credit for the transformation of Teen Vogue, but listen, I would not have been able to do half of what I did and what our team did, really, without the support of someone at the top who gave a space to experiment and to flip the model on its head and to do things that no magazine speaking to young people had ever done before. And so I give her a lot of credit for that. She's a fierce leader, and she made me a better leader for having worked with her.
We live in a world where you can get anything you need delivered to your door thanks to DoorDash. If you don't want to do the dishes or you feel a little sick, let DoorDash bring dinner tonight. My family uses DoorDash all the time because it connects us to our favorite restaurants without us having to drive. Last night, we got some Indian food for my wife, some gumbo for me, and sushi for the kids. And everyone was happy, and we didn't have to do the dishes. The process of ordering was quick and easy, and I love DoorDash for real. So I was so happy to do this for them because I'm a customer, because I know DoorDash is your door to more. Must be over 21 to order alcohol. Alcohol available only in select markets. DoorDash, your door to more. Download the DoorDash app now to get almost anything delivered. In my mind, the greatest author of the 20th century is Toni Morrison. And her greatest novel is Song of Solomon. A mesmerizing coming-of-age masterpiece that is gorgeously written and has captivated readers around the world. The protagonist, Milkman Dead, was born shortly after a neighborhood eccentric hurled himself off a roof in a vain attempt to fly. For the rest of his life, Milkman is trying to fly. As Morrison follows Milkman on a quest to uncover his roots and find the place of his family's origin, she introduces an entire cast of strivers and liars and assassins and the inhabitants of an amazing, beautiful, fully realized Black world. The New Yorker said Morrison moves easily in and out of the lives and thoughts of her characters, luxuriating in the diversity of circumstances and personalities. Toni Morrison is a genius. She's one of the greatest writers of her time, of the century, and Song of Solomon is her greatest book, in my opinion. It's a must-read that will ignite your imagination and show you what the best possible fiction writing is like. And it's a timeless tale that will stay with you after you've turned its final page. When you get to the climax, you will feel it in your heart. Available now at tonimorrison.com or wherever books are sold.
You know, toward the end of the book, you talk about you came to New York, you came to your professional life with this mindset of bite off more than you can chew and just chew the hell out of it.
Yeah.
And I think that's definitely been my mindset. I always have 5, 6, 7 projects that I'm doing at once. I cannot get everything done.
Right.
I feel like the plate is overflowing and there's overwhelm, but like you plow through it because that's the way it is. But you really are open with yourself about this is too much. I am burned out. This is not fun. I want to be chewing as much as I can eat, or just you know, just taking it down to like a reasonable level, which is not yet where I am as a person.
I don't know if I'm there either, but I've definitely changed the mantra. By the way, I forgot to say Anna's really funny. By the way,
really
to finish that, I don't think she gets credit for being funny.
She's a funny Anna story.
She's just like I remember.
She don't seem funny. She's ice queen.
She's not as icy as she is depicted. She really isn't. I just remember this one time where we were our wellness editor at the time, Vera Papasova. Shout out to Vera. She's a genius, and she was really behind a lot of some of those award-winning stories that we did and pushing us into some more radical intersectional feminist space. Like, she's amazing. So she would present certain ideas that then I carried into the big boss. And she had an idea about tackling female masturbation and telling sort of like a historical retrospective of female masturbation. And so I had to go in to talk to Anna. And I think it's so crazy because now that might not even be jarring or shocking to people. But, you know, 5 years ago, talking to Anna about female masturbation and putting it in Teen Vogue wasn't exactly the easiest conversation to have, you know, especially shortly after being given the reins. And I'm this young Black girl, you know, one would think you should play it safe for a little while. But,
right. But
you know, I went into this meeting thinking, how am I going to say the word masturbation in front of Anna Wintour? And we were all like, it was funny going into it. But I finally got the courage and I pitched it to Anna.
And say the word?
I said the words. And she just, without flinching, without blinking, she just said, well, I don't see why not. Men have been doing it forever, talking about it. It's fine by me. And I wish I had a British accent to really be able to land that, but
right,
I have a terrible British accent, so I'm not even going to do that to myself right now.
But
I think that in and of itself, that like that share that sheds light on just how open-minded she is. She's cooler than she's been given credit for. And we ran the story, and those kinds of stories that we did, we would not have been able to do without someone at the top, a leader saying, sure. I'm much more comfortable asking the questions than I am answering them. And this has been a really interesting transition for me, going from behind the scenes to in front. And even, you know, I'm much more comfortable telling my story in a written form.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's harder for me to talk about this book. And so I'm really kind of grateful that my first podcast interview is with you, and that you create a safe space also that you are a Black male journalist. There's a lot of stuff in this book thematically that I'm sure on some level you relate to. And so I feel safer. Yeah.
The white space struggle, the magazine struggle. I mean, all that is just so near to my heart. And so much of this I really related to and was admiring you for putting out into the world. And it's a beautiful book.
Thank you.
It feels like we're coming to the end, but we're not yet.
Okay. But seriously, coming from you, that means a lot. Like, you used the word extraordinary. Like, you used the word beautiful. I mean, means I didn't even know you read the book when I walked in and you said, like, oh, I read about that.
Oh, hell yeah. Oh, yeah.
You read the book? Torre read my book?
Hell yeah. No, it is warm and welcoming and inspiring and giving and real. You do that thing of like, I'm going to be vulnerable. I'm going to tell you about how I had to pee all the time because I had a condition and people in the office were teasing me about it. I'm keeping it extra real.
Keeping it extra funky.
I mean, you know, you could have told the story about like, you know, I got the job at Teen Vogue and it was great. But it's like, but there was this other side to it that was really hard too. And you're like, I'll show you my warts. And that's a beautiful thing. But what is driving you? What do you want people to think about you? Why are you doing all this stuff? Like, what do you want them to say about you?
I don't know if I operate with that in mind.
Good.
I don't think about what people think about me.
What do you want to think about you?
That I'm being true to my call, that I'm answering my call. I think one of my favorite books is The Alchemist, and, you know, Paulo Coelho says in the book, I'm paraphrasing, but our only obligation is to actualize our dreams. And I think our dreams are actually callings. And I think they're actually divine. And we're put here on assignment, all of us. And I don't want to live my life on the other side of my calling. I don't want to ever wonder what would have happened if I was brave enough to be obedient to this big call on my life. And so I'd rather answer it, heed it, and be led. You know, I don't do anything. I'm not super strategic in the sense that I don't think about a 5-year plan.
No.
I
would have thought that
I'm
you
driven.
Did.
No, I'm driven, but I'm you know, it's interesting. I'm less driven than I am led. Does that make sense? Like, I feel led to do things.
Okay.
And I don't really do, there's not a lot that I do that I don't feel called to do. This book wrote itself in me, and I had to share it.
Okay.
You know, it wasn't like, well, now I must build my brand.
Yeah.
So I must write the book.
Yeah.
I must have a message, and I must get it out there. And this is my new platform. Like,
no.
I'm not strategic in that way. There is sort of a kind of an organic flow. And I talk about this actually in that same Burning Out chapter. Like, there is hustle.
And there's flow.
And there is flow.
Yeah.
And you must have one. You can't have one without the other. If you want to have a sustainable sort of run with success, it's a marathon. And so yeah, I feel like I'm in my flow and I want to stay in my flow. That's my goal, is to stay in flow. And actually, when I met Oprah, I interviewed Oprah last year. No, I'm not trying to drop a bomb.
We're in media. It's not name dropping, but just what an amazing sentence. When
I
met
mean,
Oprah, when
really,
I interviewed Oprah.
What an amazing sentence that I never thought I would be able to say.
Yeah.
I mean, really, I never get to a point where I take any of this for granted. Like,
right. That
was the wildest dream come true. And I hope it happens again. It was very brief. It wasn't this, like, you know, we didn't have the couch conversation, the Super Soul Sunday that I hope we have one day. But I got to interview her at the Wrinkle in Time red carpet.
Mm.
And she held on to me. First of all, she said my name and I almost passed out. And I'm like, her publicist probably just told her that right before she walked up to me.
Nope.
But she...
No.
I have
no doubt that Oprah was fully aware of, like, oh, what? Fly Black Girls doing big things? A Teen Vogue? Go, girl? Like, no doubt. She's in magazines. She knows.
She knows what's up. But it's still incredibly humbling to hear your name come out of Oprah's mouth.
Oh, my God.
And so she grabbed me like she does. You know that Oprah grip, that death grip that she gives the people she's interviewing. And she, even though I was interviewing her, and she looked at me and she said, your only job is to listen.
Mm.
Just listen for the whisper. And I remember from watching Oprah, I'm an Oprah junkie through and through. I grew up on the Oprah Winfrey Show. And I remember a long time ago, she said on her show, listen to the whisper before it comes a roar. And it stuck with me. And I believe that there's always a whisper telling you the right way to go. Not that I entirely believe in right and wrong. I think we learn from the hard stuff. I don't really believe in mistakes, but I do believe that there's this dance that we do with life. And like, when you can identify that voice, that's your intuition or your God or the universe or however you define it, man, life is fun. When you can operate and flow with the universe and catch that rhythm, like, there's another, not to just keep throwing out all these mantras, but there is another really meaningful kind of mantra that I picked up in meditation where this woman said to me, when the music changes, so must your dance.
Right.
And there is a music to life if you're listening to it. And there are times where the music changes and you feel clumsy. You're like, wait, but I was doing it this way for a long time. I had this dance down. But then life calls you to a new beat, to new rhythm. You gotta adjust. And you gotta learn the new dance moves. And I think as long as you remain open to and flexible and fluid, man, life can take you so many places you never, ever dreamed of. And I think that's what this book ultimately is about. I have so much more to do. I am certainly not done. And I'm not telling you I know everything. But this is what I know now. This is what I've learned to this point. This is my memoir so far. And I felt led to share this story. I felt led to go into some of the clumsier, harder, painful stuff, and also to share my why and my how behind the what it looks like. And this is my offering. This is my offering. It's not up to me to determine or to predict or to try to control what people are going to think about it, what they're going to think about me. Like, my job is to stay in flow. And I'm in flow. This book is literally my heartbeat, and then I'm giving it to the world, and then I'm going to move on. And there are a lot of other things that I'm going to do next. But I'm proud of that thing. That is like, I'm really proud of that thing. And it took a lot out of me to get that done in this amount of time. But I feel like it was necessary work that I had to do that only I could do. And that's all we can do, right? Is like, that's the goal, is do the work that only you can do, that operate in your zone of genius and just be true to your calling. So that's what I did with that book.
Last thing.
Yeah.
What's your superpower?
I can't believe you're turning on my question on me. This is the question I ask y'all. Like, really, it's in every interview that I ask people this. It's crazy that I've never had to really define it.
This is every show we ask people this question, because I love the answers, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's why you're out here asking it, because it's a great question.
It's such a great question that I should ask myself more often. I think that my superpower is connection. I think that I'm able to figure out relatively quickly how to see someone and make them feel seen. I think I have a gift of creating space for people to be who they are. And to be seen. And I think part of that is because I've been on a journey to really own all of who I am and to move through the world authentically. And I think by doing that, it gives permission to other people to do the same.
There is a permanence to this that does not attend our articles, mm-hmm. certainly does not attend our tweets mm-hmm. and our IG posts. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, your children will pick this up one day and check it out. And like, my children have not read any of my books.
Yet.
And they are not interested in reading any of my books. But this will last forever on your bookshelf, on other people's bookshelves. Yeah. It's really, you know, crazy thing.
There's a beauty in bookmaking. Yeah. Yes. That feels even more special today in this ephemeral world of social media where nothing lasts forever. And it's just one tweet to the next, one post to the next. But yeah, this
short,
is
short, tiny yes. stories. And here you're like, let me take you back.
Yeah.
Let me tell you the whole story.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's powerful. And I think it's important. And I also think it's important to have more and more Black and Brown authors in the bookstore.
Preach. So, yeah. I hope that I'm just one voice in a chorus of voices. And I hope that this book gives permission to other young, aspiring Black writers to just write the book.
Yes.
Write the book. There's space for it. There's a demand for it. There's an audience. And I hope I'm just part of sort of proving that there's a market. And you don't have to be 60, wealthy, you know, extraordinary, a mogul to have a story that's valid enough to be told.
Right.
And I had to tell myself that through this process. I mean, my brother even over Christmas said to me, "Dude, Elaine, why are you writing an autobiography?"
I love how your brother calls you dude.
He's like, "Dude, yeah." And yeah, at this point in my career, he's like the only person who will just chop me down to size real fast and just be like, he's like, "Well, dude, why are you writing an autobiography? Isn't that like something old people do?"
Wow.
Like, seriously.
But you know,
Elaine,
but is he older or younger brother?
He's older than me. And he didn't mean it to be like hurtful. But he's
not understanding the history of Black literature, which is quite often your autobiography is the first book that you publish. And you may publish it in your 20s or your 30s or whatever, but like I had to tell my story. You know, my name is Richard Wright. My name is, Claude Brown. My name is whatever, I had to tell my story first before I could tell you anything else.
Oh, that's so powerful. That when you put it like that, when you put this book, in this like larger trajectory of black
autobiography, literary, the last 150 years. Oh my God!
Thank you. I'm going to take that with me because I was like, my best comeback was in the moment. They don't even call them autobiographies anymore, you asshole! And I just like burst into tears. So now I have I can come back with some weight on this. But no, I think that's powerful when you put it into perspective like that. And I just think like, listen, you don't have to be, later I realized, I was like, that's the patriarchy talking. Mm. You don't see the value yet in the voice of a young black woman. And that's okay. You're not my audience. I'm not speaking to you. And I do think that's rule number one, like write for your audience. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people who get it. And then there are going to be some who don't. Don't worry about them.
Thanks to Elaine for a great interview, and thanks to you for listening. Torre Show gives you fuel to power your dreams because you can use your dreams like a rocket ship to blast you into a life you never imagined. You can make your dreams a reality, and this show can help. I'm on Twitter @Torre and on Instagram @Torre Show. Please leave a review on iTunes and tell your friends about the show. Torre Show is written by me, Torre, and produced by Jackie Garofano. Our editor is Brandon Tago, and our photographer is Chuck Marcus. We're distributed by DCP Entertainment, and we will be back next Wednesday with another amazing person because the man can't shut us down.